evening, everyone.
Good evening.
So, we are talking about history, how the Constitution is read by the courts through the lens of history, and that's what we did yesterday. And today I want to take it one step further and talk a little bit about the right to equality in general. Hold your horses, I'm not yet talking today specifically about affirmative action, a thing that people get very heated about. I want to talk more generally about the notion of equality and non-discrimination. But you'll see it's laying the ground for what's coming tomorrow. And I want to start with a few examples to make us think about equality and non-discrimination. And what does it actually mean? And what does it mean in the South African context, given the fact that our constitutional court has said that they interpret in our constitution very much with reference to our past history and how that history still influences current day situation in South Africa. So let me use first the easiest example. Say the Springbok rugby team is selected, and instead of me or Helen Ziller, even Etzebeth or Bakis Buerta is selected as the lock. Why is that not discrimination? Think about that. Different people are selected. In the one, say make it Helen Ziller. A woman is not selected, but a man is selected. Isn't that discrimination on the basis of gender or sex? That's an easy example. Second example, also easy, I think. Say a movie producer decides to make a movie about the life of Eugene de Blanche, and they cast a white actor in the role of Eugene de Blanche. Why isn't that racial discrimination? Because there's a black actor. He's also nice and portly, he's got a beard and everything. But he cannot play Eugene de Blanche. We know none of us are going to say that it's discrimination. Now, the third example is that the law says that if you have a job and you're a woman, you're entitled to a certain amount of maternity leave. It's a complicated system, but in effect, you have a certain number of weeks of maternity leave for some pay at least. But if you're a man, you don't have the same entitlement. Is that discrimination or not? And why not? What is the difference there between the men and the women? Okay. And now, most controversial perhaps. What happens if you have an organization that says, our organization is the Black Lawyers Association. We want to advance the interest of black lawyers. Is that discrimination or not discrimination? Would it make a difference if it was a white lawyers association advancing the interest of white people? And if so, why? This is very topical because, of course, there is a black lawyers association in South Africa. There is not a white lawyers association. I mean, it would be a bit embarrassing probably for most of us to belong to a white lawyers association. Unless you're a fan of Eugene de Blanche.
Black Lawyers Association does admit white members.
Sorry?
Black Lawyers Association does admit white members.
They say they admit white members, but they say, let's make it more complicated. Forget about what they actually do. Say they say, as an organization, we are only going to advance the interest of black lawyers, so we're only admitting black lawyers. We don't want white lawyers there because they make us feel uncomfortable. They always take over and talk too much. You know how white people are. Sorry, I'm making this now. Okay, so how do we have to think about this? Now, the starting point, it seems to me, is once again, if you ask the Constitutional Court, the Constitutional Court is going to try and solve each one of those issues, those examples, by saying, well, we have to actually look at the actual practical reality that we live in. And to do that, we have to once again look at the past. So one of the first judgments of the Constitutional Court, in Brink versus Kitsoff, the Constitutional Court said that when we engage with when is something discrimination or not, when is it constitutionally valid, when is it not, because of course we know that the law, both the law but also ordinary people, every day make distinctions between people. Some of them are constitutionally problematic, some are not. The court said once when we try and decide when are they problematic, when they are not, we're going to look at our past and we're going to ask ourselves what are the consequences of the situation we find ourselves in now because of what happened in the past. So in that Brink versus Kitsoff report, once again, you know, the same story that it's quoted in different passages in many judgments. And I'll just quote a small bit from the judgment. Said, black people were prevented from becoming owners of property or even residing in areas classified as so-called white, which constituted nearly 90% of the landmass of South Africa, that is in apartheid South Africa. Senior jobs and access to established schools and universities were denied to them. Civic communities, including transport system, public parks, libraries, many shops, were also closed to black people. And the court said, if you want to make understanding of this issue, you will have to take that into account. Later, in other cases, the court said, well, and this goes back to what we said yesterday, that one must be careful to have one story about the past. The court said, well, when we think about the past, we must also understand that in the past, there were other forms of egregious discrimination and an egregious form of prejudice that was perpetuated by legislation or by the public discourse, by religious organizations and so on, against gay men and lesbians, against people living with HIV, against women, against people who are disabled and so on. So you must keep that in mind, that we have that history and it had created certain consequences and certain results for who has power in our society, who don't have power, who has social status, who don't have social status, who have economic power, who doesn't have economic power, and so on. Now, as I said, the situation, no, I haven't said that actually, the situation is complicated further by even if we forget what happened there in the past, let's forget about that. My first example about Eben Etzebeth and what's his name? Bakkies Botha. He's such a player then, you know. He's another one, there used to be one, Klippi Skritzinger. Not very funny name. Very funny names, but okay. They are very different in the way they are built than, say, I am. You know, I think Bakkies Botha is that high. You know, he would even strike the balance in him. So people are different. No two people are the same. Some people can run fast. Other people can't run fast. Some people are going to win the Miss World competition, not only because they want to save the world, but also because they're very beautiful. Others are not. So we're all different. So there's that problem also, that there are actually real differences between people. So women can fall pregnant, men cannot fall pregnant. The actor who is going to have a relatively a pinkish color is going to look more like a ginger blonde than the actor who is going to have a slightly darker color. So there are absolute fundamental differences. So, and the question is, do they matter, don't they matter? Can we make the distinctions or not? Now, what does the Constitution actually say? You know, it's always, it's a bit like when you're in a constitutional law lecture or discussion, it's a bit like being in church. You always go to the text verse from the Bible, but the Bible is the Constitution. So I'm reading from section 9 of the Constitution, brothers and sisters. Section 9 says, firstly, everyone is equal before the law and has the right to protection and benefit of the law. So there's a general statement that everybody is equal before the law and has the right to protection and benefit of the law. So there's a general equality claim. But just when you think that's easy, section 9.2 then, in a way, qualifies that and says, equality includes the full and equal enjoyment of all rights and freedoms. So there cannot be equality if people do not equally enjoy the rights and freedoms in the Bill of Rights. And to promote the achievement of equality, so equality is not something we already have, it is something that must be achieved still, the achievement of equality. To promote it, legislative and other measures designed to protect or advance persons or categories of persons disadvantaged by unfair discrimination may be taken. So in other words, affirmative action will be granted. But we're going to park that section. Tomorrow night we're going to talk about that. I really want to talk about section 9.3 of the Constitution, because it says, actually, yes, everybody's equal, but that doesn't, it's very difficult to operationalize that in law, because actually the law makes everyday distinctions between people, and human beings make distinctions between people. When you decide to invite somebody to a bride, and you don't invite the other person because they insulted you at the bridge club the other night, that is a distinction you are making. Okay, so the law makes distinctions. And to say everybody's equal must be say it doesn't really, it's very difficult to give it some, it doesn't really feel like it has tangible weight. So that is why section 9.3 is very important. And section 9.3 says this: the state may not unfairly discriminate directly or indirectly against anyone on one or more ground, and then it lists 16 specific grounds, but it's not a closed list. It's just a list that is in the Constitution, but the court can invent new grounds. That list of grounds includes, of course, race, sex, gender, sexual orientation, age, disability, religion, language, what else? Conscience, belief, culture, and birth. Later on, the court said things like HIV status and whether you're a foreigner or not must also be added in there, because they are also sort of the same kind of attributes or characteristics that they are similar to these that are listed here. Now, if you look at that section 9, the most important part of that section to understand how our court deals with equality in this, by trying to grapple with wanting to achieve equality at the same time wanting to respect people's dignity, and at the same time trying to remember that we come from a specific past where some people were treated very unequally to others, and that those consequences still linger. If you want to understand how the court manages this process, you have to focus on one word, and that is unfairly. So in our jurisprudence, and it sounds, of course, for most people a bit weird to say, in our jurisprudence, discrimination is perfectly acceptable. Discrimination, I put it in inverted commas. But unfair discrimination is not acceptable. So the unfair, the unfairness is the pivot around which equality and non-discrimination jurisprudence in our court's jurisprudence revolve. And a lot then turns about on how do we decide what is fair and what is unfair. And this is obviously not an easy thing to do, and I'm going to try and explain to you. But before I get there, I want to say, make a preliminary point, conceptual point. And that is that When the court chose this idea of unfairness, when I jumped on that word in the Constitution, they did so because they said, if you look at our Constitution and the fact that it includes the unfair discrimination is prohibited, that means that our Constitution has chosen, or the drafters of the Constitution has chosen one kind of conception of equality above another. And to understand how they engage with unfairness, I think it's important to understand those two conceptions of equality, broadly speaking, that are prevalent in the jurisprudence and in the writing about equality and non-discrimination, and then just to contrast them and see how they differ. And the two conceptions of equality is, there's a traditional formal conception of equality, and then there's the conception of equality, substantive equality, which the Constitutional Court said is embedded really in our Constitution. Now, what is formal equality? Formal equality is very much the approach that the US Supreme Court follows, especially more recently. And it is based on the assumption that people are born free and equal, and that that formally it is necessary to treat people the same, especially when you cannot treat people differently because of obnoxious distinctions that people have drawn between individuals or groups of individuals in the past. So formal equality insists on equal treatment for men and women, equal treatment for black people and white people, and maybe in a few thousand years also for gay people and straight people. They're not there yet in the US. But in theory, it should really be the same, but of course it isn't always. Formal equality really says that we're not going to look beyond what the law says. We're not going to look at the effects of the law. We're not going to ask whether the people involved in the different treatment are more or less equal, whether they've had equal opportunities, whether they have equal life chances, whether they have equal power to actually make a success of their life. We are going to be blind to the context. We are going to be blind to the history. We are going to treat humans as humans. And we're going to assume all humans are exactly the same, they are all equal, and that means they must be treated exactly in the same manner. That is a formal notion of equality. You can imagine a formal notion of equality makes, if you embrace that, the idea of affirmative action will go out of the window. You can't have the two things. They are completely in a clash with one another. Our Constitutional Court has said, maybe for that reason, and predicting already, because you know these things, the court is not stupid, they already knew they were going to come cases of affirmative action. So even when it was ordinary cases dealing with discriminations against women or discriminations against gay men and lesbians, the court said, well, we are embracing, because of the unfairness principle in our jurisprudence, in our text of the Constitution, we embrace the idea of substantive equality. And what is substantive equality? That says, well, you can't, when you look at equality, what you really have to look at is the impact or the effect that different treatment is going to have. You have to look at people's position in society. Where there are patterns of discrimination, disadvantage, and harm based on a person's personal characteristics and attributes, like their race, their sex, their gender, their sexual orientation. You have to take that into account to decide whether the different treatment is fair or unfair. And you must also look at broadly how the society is structured. And you must ask whether, on the face of it, equal treatment is not actually perpetuating inequality. So So substantive equality, for example, will say, well, we have to see that men and women, and the position of men and women, to use a less controversial example, are different. Women get pregnant, men don't. In our, because of cultural factors, men, women often are expected to look after children, while the men are less, there are less pressure on men to look after children. That has consequences for people in the workplace and so on. So maybe it is not fair to insist on exactly equal treatment for men and women in all places, because that that would make us blind to the actual reality of people's lives. It will make us blind to how what happened in the past and how the past is still helping to structure the present day reality. It will make us blind to that, and it will make it unfair. So that is the argument of substantive equality. And so for that reason, the court said, we are really going to look at the impact. What is the impact of a specific provision? And by doing that, we're going to decide on whether something is fair or unfair. Okay, so I hope you're all still with me with the substantive and formal equality. Okay, so that is the general approach, a bit of the vibe that I spoke about last night towards equality that the court said, that they chose one path and one vision about of equality above another because they were interpreting the Constitution very much in the context of what is the Constitution trying to achieve. It's trying actually to make sure that we're not going to perpetuate inequality in society by being blind to the actual reality of people's lives. That was the argument that the court made. So, that's very important. There's a second important principle, I think, that is very, that to understand how equality jurisprudence works. And that is that Section 9(3) also doesn't only say that unfair discrimination is prohibited. It says unfair discrimination, whether direct or indirect, is prohibited. Now, what does that mean? It means that the court said that the drafters of our Constitution understood that often discrimination is hidden. Sometimes it's direct. So if a law is passed, the law says only white people can go into a post office, or there must be separate entrances for white and black people for the post office, or only white people can swim on Clifton Beach. That is clear, direct discrimination. You actually make a distinction between two groups of people in which you mention the ground of discrimination, whether it's race, sex, gender, sexual orientation, whatever. But, said the court, our constitutional drafters understood that often discrimination can be hidden in what looks like a neutral rule. Often a rule that is on its face treating everybody the same can actually have the effect, see, it's linked to the substantive equality, can have an impact on a group that one cannot immediately see. For example, if the Minister of the Police issues a new regulation that says you can only become a police officer, a member of the South African Police Services, if you at least 1.8 meters tall. That is 6 foot, maybe. I still think in foot is the only thing I can. Yeah, but in any case. So, what is that? That is a neutral rule. It's treating everybody the same. Nobody under 6 foot, 1.8 meters, can become a police officer. But what is going to happen? Well, unless you're Naomi Campbell, as a woman, you're probably not going to make it into the police service. So, it is a neutral rule. But if you look behind it, you see, the effect of the rule is it's going to exclude almost all women, and it's going to exclude far less men. In the same way, there was a court case, Pretoria City Council versus Walker, in which the City Council of Pretoria made a distinction between how they treated rent, electricity payment defaulters in Waterkloof. Again, if you know Pretoria, Waterkloof is like Constantia, but only with a lot of Afrikaans. And Mamelodi and Atrichville, which is like Nyanga and Langa, basically. Okay. So the municipality said, we're not discriminating against anyone. We're treating people differently based on where they stay. We don't know that all the white people stay in Waterkloof, all the black people stay in Mamelodi and Atrichville. That is just a coincidence. Oh, you don't even know. And the court said, no, that is a perfect example of indirect discrimination, where you're trying to hide behind, you use other factors actually as a proxy for the discrimination, and you make it a neutral rule, but the rule's effect is not actually neutral. Okay, so what does that then mean for there's actually one other thing I need to say before I go on. And that is, what I didn't read to you is section 9.4 of the Constitution, which states, if I can find it now, I'll read you the exact quote, which states that no person may unfairly discriminate directly or indirectly against anyone on one of the grounds listed in section 9.3. In other words, it says that the prohibition on discrimination doesn't only apply to the state. Old-fashioned constitutions and bills of rights is said to only apply vertically between an individual and the state. So if the state takes away your rights, you can take the state to court and then say that the state has infringed your rights. Section 9.4 makes it clear the other rights may be also, is maybe the same, but for our purposes, we'll just stick to what Section 9.4 actually says. It makes it clear that an individual person can also challenge another person, or a company, or an institution that is not the state, for discriminating against them. So if you go to, a restaurant or a bar. This happened to me once with my former partner. We went to a bar and I walked in, he was behind me, and then he never came in. And I thought, where is he now? You know, talking again with the people outside. I went outside, they said, no, you can't come in, he's not properly dressed. The difference between us, I'm white, he's black. So, and the people said, well, the right of admission is reserved. This is a private institution. But in the end, we took them to court. We challenged them for discrimination and won the case. Because Section 9.4 says, a private individual or company or institution cannot discriminate against somebody else. So that's quite important. That's quite powerful. The reason for that is that the argument is that often, the old concept of human rights as only applying to the state completely misunderestimated. Underestimated. You didn't say that once, don't misunderestimate. It completely underestimates the way in which private companies exercises extreme power over us as individuals. So if you go to the Vodacom shop, you know they make you sign a contract. I don't know if you've ever read the contract. I haven't. I'm a lawyer, but I've never read the contract. I can't read the end of that. But once you try challenging, there is all kinds of fine print where you sign the way you like. And of course, you can't really insist on not signing the contract. They will just chase you away. So private companies have a lot of power. Banks. So for this reason, the Constitution explicitly makes the the equality provisions apply to private individuals. And Parliament has actually now enacted this legislation, the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act. The lawyers call it PAPUDA. And that act is now the one that you're going to invoke in private cases. You can take it to the Equality Court. Okay, but having said all that, let's get now to the heart of the matter and think about when is something fair and when is something unfair. And then we can think back to our examples and think how they will come out in the court cases. The court said generally when we, before we forget now, we're not talking remember now today about affirmative action. We're just talking general distinctions that people make between people. And when is it fair, when is it not fair? The court first said, you cannot talk about discrimination if it's not distinction made directly or indirectly on one of those grounds that are listed in the Constitution or that are similar to that. So if you make a distinction between lawyers and doctors, it is not discrimination. Because there's nothing in the Section 9 that says you cannot discriminate unfairly against lawyers. It says you cannot discriminate against people on the basis of race, sex, gender, sexual orientation, age, disability and whatnot. And the court added HIV status and so on. But lawyers and doctors, the court will say, well, you know, these people are not really people who have suffered a long history of oppression and marginalization. These will make fun of them, but they're actually pretty well off. And so that distinction is not going to fly. So the first thing you have to show is that there was actually discrimination in the sense that either directly or indirectly, you've made a distinction. The law or private institution made a distinction between people based on their race, their sex, their gender, their sexual orientation, their age, their disability, their language, their religion, and whatever. And once you have done that, then you ask, okay, is this fair or is it unfair? And here we get back to the history and the concept and the way in which the court takes that into account and takes into account how the history, our history as a country coming through apartheid has molded and has produced certain effects in how people's position in society differ. Okay. And they do it in the following way. It's a kind of, the fairness and unfairness is a kind of weighing up of different interests. And what is at the heart of that weighing up, the court said, we don't want the law or anybody, any person, to treat people in a way that is going to attack the inherent human dignity. Because there's a notion that every human being comes from Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, that every human being, just because they're a human being, has an inherent human dignity. So whether you lying in the gutter, looking up at the stars like Oscar Wilde, or whether you are the president, you have exactly the same inherent human dignity. And you cannot be treated in a way that is going to send a signal that somehow you don't count as a human being, that you have no worth, moral worth as a human being, because then your inherent human dignity is taken away. How does the court do that? Well, the court says we look at different things. Firstly, we're going to look at the position of the complainant and the group that the complainant belongs to in society. And we're going to ask, is this person belonging to a group, and is the discrimination based on one of those criteria of a group that has suffered in the past or continues to suffer discrimination or the effects, the lingering effects of that discrimination? So what does that mean? The court said, obviously, it will be far easier to show that discrimination is unfair and therefore unconstitutional if the discrimination is against a group who have in the past suffered from discrimination are still suffering from the consequences of that discrimination. So to put it very bluntly, it would be easier to show unfair discrimination against a black person than a white person. It would be easier to show discrimination against a woman than against a man. It would be easier to show discrimination against a disabled person than against an able-bodied person, against a gay and lesbian person than against a heterosexual person. But that's not the end all. It's not just, oh, you're white or you're black, you win or you lose. That would be a bit too simplistic. So the second thing the court looks at, it says, we look, what is the purpose of the discrimination? So, for my examples, this will be very relevant to many of the examples. The purpose of the discrimination is so clear, so obvious, important that it trumps any indignity that the person who is actually suffering the discrimination might feel, and in a way negates, the court will say, basically negates that indignity, the affront to the indignity that the person will feel. So the purpose is very important of the discrimination. Say for example, so I'll use another example just to make this point clear. There's a law that says if you want to get a driver's license and have it renewed, you have to go to the wherever, and then you must have an eye test. Then they make that thing with a little red light which you never know where it is going. If you fail the eye test, you cannot have your license renewed. So if your eyesight is failing and you become blind, you stop being eligible to get a license. Now that is discrimination against people on the basis of their disability, surely. Because you are making distinctions between people purely on the basis that some people can see, others can't see. It's discrimination, but the purpose of the discrimination is relatively important. Because if you are going to allow anybody who's not going to be able to see to drive, it's going to be a bit of a tricky situation. Because we have not yet invented a car, as far as I know, that can drive without a person who can actually see. It's coming apparently, but I'm a little bit nervous for that car. So the purpose is important, and the purpose can be for many things. It can, you know, it can be, you can take into account the purpose is to actually make sure that the person who's being, the person who's being treated better than the other person. That the reason for that better treatment is because there's an inherent difference between two people. So for example, the law that says, You are entitled to maternity leave if you're a woman but not a man, the court will say, well, there's a purpose. You as a woman are actually the one who's having the baby, although the husband often thinks that it's him. So therefore, there's actually a very good purpose for you to get the maternity leave. It is nice to have for the husband also, because maybe then the husband will learn how to also look after the baby, but it is not so inherent. There's a difference in the way, there's a good purpose or good reason for the different gene. And then, once the court has looked at the purpose, it has looked at the person and the group they belong to, then the court says, well, is it fair or unfair? And we ask this by asking, looking at the whole picture, and looking at our assessment and taking into account that vibe of the Constitution that we spoke about yesterday, where we're coming from, and the injustices that we're trying to get rid of and that we are getting rid of, but it's taking time. Taking all that, is this fair or unfair? Is it infringing on the human dignity of the individual person? So in my examples, the first example is clear. The distinction between me and Bapis Buddha, there is not really a distinction in terms of race or sex or gender. So I don't think I'm going to be able to convince them. Helen Zinner will be able to say, well, there's discrimination on the basis of sex or gender. But the purpose of the distinction that is being made in the discrimination is clear. We are not going to beat the All Blacks if Helen Zinner plays. No disrespect to the cinema. She's not going to be able to catch the ball, and she's not in the line. Okay. So, in the situation of Eugene de Blanche, once again, there is a discrimination, but there is a very good purpose for the discrimination, because you can't really have an actor playing somebody who doesn't look at all like the character that they're supposed to play. The whole movie is not going to have credibility. The difficult one would be the Black Lawyers Association. Because it will all depend on, the court will look at two things. The court will look, okay, who's being discriminated against? It is, say, white people who are now going to feel excluded. We cannot join the Black Lawyers Association. We assume that they are exclusive. But in the past, white lawyers had it sort of pretty cushy in South Africa. White lawyers still have it pretty cushy. In my opinion. I mean, I have it pretty cushy, actually. The court is going to probably say, they can be a problem, but we are not inordinately alarmed. Then it will depend on the purpose. You have to go to the Black Lawyers Association and say, why? What the hell are you doing here? And then they will have to come up with a good reason. I think what the Black Lawyers Association will say is, we are still a minority. We don't have the power in the legal profession. We are outvoted and outgunned at the annual general meetings. And we are made to feel inferior because people say, you are only here because you're affirmative action candidate in any case or whatever. And so we need a safe space where we can come together, talk about our problems, have a drink, and hopefully try and think about how we can change the system to make it more fair for everyone. The White Lawyers Association would have it more difficult, I think. I think the court might actually buy that argument. Say, in the bigger picture, given where we are at, given that there are still inequalities between, say, black and white lawyers, that there are still far more white lawyers than black lawyers, that there is still a difference in social status, economic status of many, but not all black lawyers and white lawyers, then maybe it is not going to really send a signal that it trans white people's dignity. But the White Lawyers Association is going to sound very much like wanting to perpetuate white privilege. And for that reason, the court is probably going to say, not going to happen. So for that very reason, I think, not a court judgment, but in an opinion of the Human Rights Commission, where some heterosexual person challenged a bed and breakfast here in Sea Point, I think it was called Amsterdam, they only allowed gay people to go there. And the straight person said, this is discriminating against me. I also want to go there, and check out all the beautiful men. And the homeless said, and the Human Rights Commission agreed with this, well, gay people, if you go to the local bed and breakfast in Riviersonder End, and you want to hold your boyfriend's hand there, then they're all going to look at you as if you are Julius Malema. And you're going to feel very uncomfortable. So maybe there's safe space needed. And it doesn't really hurt anybody because there are thousands of other big places that the heterosexual people can go to in Sea Point. And so they said it wouldn't be unfair discrimination as such.
Okay, so I tried to give you some examples.
I want to just conclude before I allow you to ask some questions by saying that I don't want to create the impression that this is a very formalistic mechanism through which the court acts. I think the court is grappling very hard with trying to balance two very different things. On the one hand, it is trying to grapple with the fact that we are not all equal, and they are often, apart from the fact that we were just born differently, some people can run fast and some people can't, there are other reasons why we are not equal. We don't have the same opportunities. you know, either because of the ways we are men and women, because of patriarchy and sexism, because of homophobia, because of racism, because of the effects of apartheid. We try to take that into account, but then at the same time, we are trying to be fair to everyone and not allow the creation of new patterns of discrimination, disadvantage, harm. And the court has also said in several cases that this approach depends extremely much on the context. So yes, the court takes into account our history, where we're coming from, and see how that history has deformed in a way our society. But of course, over time, that deformity will reform, so to speak, hopefully. It will become different. And then the court will take different factors into account. So it's not set in stone. Forever and ever, men are going to be found to be less likely to be discriminated against unfairly than women or black people, or white people than black people, and so on. It depends on the context. So having said that, and each case is a case-by-case thing that depends on the facts of the specific case. People don't understand it because they say it must be clear-cut. But as I said yesterday, the law is not a science. It is very much an art. I think it's a bit like writing literature. You're trying to get to that sweet spot where you think things are actually fair. And sometimes I think the court gets it right. Sometimes it gets it wrong. And then when they get it wrong, we can criticize them. It's not that we live in a free country. But in any case, that is my spiel. So maybe you want to ask me now questions or comment or whatever. Yes?
I think from a sporting point of view, perhaps a better comparison would be things like golf clubs.
Yes.
Where they have different rules and practices applying to men and women for the very simple reason that the way they play the game tends to be different.
Yes.
Because of physical strength. Mm. Would that extend to the fact, as I said, men only and women?
Oh, that is an interesting point, because I said, remember, that the discrimination is also against private institutions, like a golf club. But obviously it cannot be against any private institution. So if you invite people to your home to come and taste some wine, you only invite men, or only white men, that would be helpful. The law is not going to interfere there, because you are not offering any service. A service which, if you had access to it, might have enhanced your opportunities in life. Because a golf course is, of course, a place of pleasure, but we know deals are also struck on golf courses. There are also ways in which certain people use the golf course to achieve other goals. So the court is going to say a golf course that only has men and not women, that they're probably going to say that it's unfair. Interesting, if the golf course only had women and not men, I wonder what they would say. Because they might say, yes, women, they are vilified, they say, oh, you play so pathetic, they don't play like a girl, or white women. Yeah, so I don't know, I'm thinking about it now, yes.
You want to comment on the Department of Correctional Services case in the case?
Well, the case has now gone to the Supreme Court of Appeal, and they have found against the case. That is dealing specifically with corrective measures as such, as employed in the Employment Equity Act. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit tomorrow, because it goes to the question of relative disadvantage. And the question of putting absolute barriers to advancement in the workplace. So let's start. I'm going to answer your question, I hope. If I don't, ask me tomorrow again. Yeah.
When a person appeals in court with various cases against him and all the complainants of him, and can that person then pay a certain amount of money and the case of being dismissed?
No, well, the question is, if you go to court, can one of the parties actually come and have the case dismissed because they have more money and they can basically buy off? Yeah, that cannot, well,
I don't know if it may not have happened in certain instances, but if it does happen, it is utterly and fundamentally illegal. Because you have a right to a fair trial, and you have a right of access to court to have your dispute settled there. But it is not necessarily, of course, an issue of discrimination. The reason for that is that, and we can discuss this, this is, if you're a Marxist, then you're going to have a big problem with that aspect of the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't prohibit discrimination on the basis of your economic status. So if you are poor, you can be discriminated against. It's only when your poverty intersects with your race, your class, and so on, that it is declared unfair. So, so there's interesting discussions about how that entrenches inequality in other ways that is not necessarily race-based. But it's a difficult issue.
If a non-government organization has a vacancy,
yes,
and they advertise there's a job available, are they allowed to say that nobody can apply for this job if they are married? And are they allowed to say that if a single person applies for this job and gets married, they have to give up the job?
I would almost certainly think that such a case would be unfair discrimination. Because the Constitution and the Equality Act both prohibits unfair discrimination on the basis of marital status. So it's discrimination. People, especially if it's a woman, if it's a different sex marriage and the woman partner, there's a long history of people being discriminated. And the court has already said, as I said yesterday, the right to dignity also implies that you have a right to be married, and that there's something profoundly personally important for two people to be together. So to force people to make that choice, to marry or not to marry, I think would be such an invasion of a person's dignity that the court would say that even if there is a relatively good purpose, like married people are going to have the babies, you cannot do that either. You cannot discriminate in employment because somebody is going to get pregnant, or because the people are going to have less time, they actually will have to go home and actually be with somebody. That is not a good reason. That's not a good enough.
Would they make an exception for the Catholic Church?
Of course they would. And here, you see, now you are catching me up. Because what I didn't say is, of course, that sometimes rights collide with one another. And the right to freedom of religion is in direct tension with the right not to be discriminated against. So our courts have struggled very much with that issue. Because they try very hard to accommodate both the secular and the sacred, as they say. But I guess, especially because the Catholic Church is quite powerful, because you must never forget the politics of judicial review. Because the Catholic Church is powerful and so on, the court is going to say, we cannot order the Catholic Church to allow people to get married, or whatever, or to allow women priests. That's both of discrimination. Yeah. So I suspect the right to freedom of religion there in that particular case will trump the other one. I suspect, yeah. Yes?
Why do the opposition parties say that if the secrecy law comes into law, they will take it to the Constitutional Court because they said they will win in the Constitutional Court?
Yeah.
Now, on what grounds would they then win that case?
Okay, that's a bit off point, but I'll answer it in any case. The secrecy bill, which is not yet been signed by the president, he's been sitting on his hands with that one. But it went through about 15 different drafts. The first version was truly draconian, looked like something that was passed by the Russian parliament. So now the version that they have now, I think, will still be unconstitutional for several reasons, but the most important reason is, it says that people can classify documents
if it is in the if the national security is threatened. But national security is not properly defined. It says, it just says national security will include the following. But in the law, when the phrase is, this definition will include, it means it could also include anything else that the Minister of State Security might decide. So he might think that national security will also include any information about a certain fire pool. So for that reason, I suspect it will be found to be unconstitutional. Yeah.
Questions. Yeah. One is that notice you mentioned in the example that says
right of
admission resolution.
Yes, yeah.
We still see it quite often.
Yes, but so it's not really enforceable in the context of discrimination. Yeah.
So people might as well not have it.
No, they can have it in the sense of if somebody truly comes into there and the person is falling down drunk, you know, like just been to the right room. And now you don't want that person there. They are walking like this, they are falling over their seat on the floor. Now you take them out. That's perfectly, you have that right. But what you can't do is to tell people, oh, you can only come in here because you must be dressed in this way, because that's often the code word for you have to be white. My students tell me. No, so.
Can you
mute on your
microphone?
Oh, yes, I can do that. Sorry. I'm so enthusiastic. Yes.
Okay.
The other one is the various acts that have been drawn up since we've had the Constitution, speaking in particular of the Children's Act. Are they drawn up with not only the Constitution in mind, but this, what you've been talking about today? Kind of like redressing the past so to make it fairer for people, black people who've been suffered before, and therefore the Children's Act would have certain examples that would.
Well, in the first 10 years of the democracy, there were lots of new pieces of, really big pieces of legislation that was really imbued with that spirit of trying to find that balance between trying to change things by doing it in a sort of structured and systematic manner. I think maybe the last 5 years, the legislation, mainly because, in my personal opinion, the NGOs who really fight for these values very strongly, and were sort of, many NGOs were really in partnership with the government. But in the last 5 or 10 years maybe, the NGOs started becoming more oppositional to the government. And so their influence on the lawmaking and what is in the legislation when it is drafted has dwindled. There are fewer really progressive people who are actually advising the government when they make legislation. So I think the legislation that we see coming through Parliament has become less progressive in the last few years. And so there's also been more cases of post-1994 legislation being declared invalid in the last 5 or 7 years. In the first 10 or 15 years, almost not, you know, many of the pieces of legislation that was declared invalid was passed by the apartheid government. So it has to do with the dynamics, the political dynamics of the governing party, the relationship with NGOs, and also I think the governing party in some ways have become more conservative, my personal view. Especially on social issues, children, you know, it's more punishment, it's more, people must know their place in society and so on. In my view at least, yes.
The success of this depends on the 11 people sitting in the Constitutional Court. Is it your view that we have a process that selects the most perfect 11 for this job?
No, of course we don't have the process that selects the most perfect 11 people. Selecting judges is very difficult. I read the other day that politics is all about who decides, and who decides, who decides. So, in our case, who decides is the Judicial Service Commission. Who decides are basically some lawyers and some politicians. The reasons why the JSC was constructed in the way it was the politicians felt we cannot just entrust lawyers to decide who the judges will be. Because then it is a self-perpetuating old boys club in which the people are going to only promote their friends. You know, it's very insular. And they are the, and they are going to, maybe it will be people from with very specific point of view, politically, ideologically, experience about the world and so on. And so it will not, it will be bad for the legitimacy of the judiciary. On the other hand, the judges and the lawyers said, we cannot just have politicians doing it, because that is how it was done under apartheid. You know that the Minister of Justice basically appointed members of the judiciary under apartheid. And so it's a combination. Until President Zuma took over and replaced some of the members of the JSC with people who are maybe more, the argument is, more strictly adhering to the ANC party line. The system worked quite well. The JSC balanced the need for transformation of the judiciary, which is necessary for the legitimacy of the court, with making sure that progressive people of all races and genders are appointed. Now, there's a tendency, I think, to appoint more conservative white and black judges. Conservative socially and conservative on issues of law and order and all these things. But all is not lost, I think, because I always remember what I read once about a Minister of Justice in apartheid era. I think it was Oswald Pirow, he was also a Nazi. And he complained and said, the problem with these bloody judges that I appoint is, once they are appointed, they think they've been appointed on merit and they start thinking for themselves. And that also happens with South African judges. People who are thought to be sound judges who are going to toe the party line, once they hit in there, you know, they start becoming independent. Oh, last question, yes.
I disagree with you about the maternity leave.
Yes.
If you look at the historical sort of gender role, you look at how work is divided, both in the home and at work, you would think that you'd need to kind of redefine those roles in paternity leave. I think the moment's between 3 to 5 days.
Yeah.
And how do you then get to change structures within the home if you don't have that kind of progressive behavior within?
Yeah, well, as I understand the law, you have that very small period, but then you can claim 2/3 of your salary from the unemployment insurance for how many months? 6 months or something like that, you know, while you're on maternity leave. So it's not a perfect system. I think it could be more progressive. I think women should have like 3 months paid maternity leave, but the law isn't like
that. I'm specifically talking about men, though.
Oh, men. Maternity, yeah. The Constitutional Court in a case, the Hugo case, had to grapple with that thing about to what extent they are going to interfere in cases where the legislature is taking account of the actual practical realities in society. And to what extent are they going to require the law to actually attack those structures that perpetuates the gender inequality between men and women, for example. Because it was about a law that President Mandela had pardoned women prisoners who had children younger than 12, but not men prisoners. And the man said, I look after the child. This is sexist. You are assuming that only women look after children. And the majority in that case said, yes, it is sexist in the sense that, but this is the way the world is. The law is just tracking the way that most people organize their lives, so we're not going to say that it's unfair. I disagreed with that judgment, actually. I was with the Judge Crickler, the minority, who said, you're perpetuating the stereotypes that women are supposed to look after children. And of course we know, as Judge Crickler in that case said, it is the biggest exploitation because people are not paid to look after children. It's all free work. It's the biggest scam in the universe. But in any case. I said the last question, but one last question, yeah.
Your comments on the constitutional statement that only 4 members of the Constitutional Court need to be judges at the time that they're appointed.
Yeah.
Is that not a total imbalance in the court?
Well, the fact of the matter is that there has never been a situation in which the majority of judges on the Constitutional Court had not served on the judiciary before. That provision really was a transitional provision that as now you cannot, the Judicial Service Commission doesn't really appoint people to the Constitutional Court who hasn't served on another court yet. That provision was to try and get new blood into the Constitutional Court. Academics, people like Cato Reagan, who used to be an academic here, and human rights lawyers like Arthur Chaskerson, who became the head of the court. But I guess you can make an argument and say if they now were to use and just appoint people who have never served as judges, and most of them are not, have never served as judges, it will be a problem. But at the moment, that is not the practice. The practice is, that now, you cannot be on the Constitutional Court if you haven't first served on another court, at least for a few years.
No, I accept that, but I'm puzzled by the provision.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so that is for tonight. Tomorrow we're going to look more specifically at the idea of affirmative action. So we'll think about it in the context of employment law, but also in the context, in more general context, and we'll see, we will learn what we have discussed today. Thank you very much.